So, it's Jess and John. How you guys doing?
Good,
ladies and gentlemen.
Good.
So
good.
You know good. That should tell you to anyone listening: go to the bathroom, make yourself a cup of tea, get a snack, take a nap. You know, pace yourself.
We're settling in.
Yeah, in. you're with us for the long haul now. If you have a road trip to go on, you know, save it for then. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So. Lately, I feel like a little bit like Elrond from Lord of the Rings, because all of his like buddies are like packing it up and leaving, and John's packing up. Steve from the other pod's packing up. He's everyone's going, moving to the Elven New World, Asia. They're leaving Middle Earth, or whatever this place is called, Middle America. The elves are leaving Middle America.
The elves are leaving.
Yeah.
For their homeland. Yeah. Yeah. The land nobody else is allowed to go to.
Yeah, and it's been interesting, because I feel like a lot of people have been noticing that things are not quite right. Things are not quite normal in America, and I don't think it's just I'm trying to get my head around it too. I'm thinking about it all the time for some reason. And one of the things, and John, you kind of triggered this idea, these thoughts in me a little bit, because I know you have sort of like a theological background. And Justin and I have long talked about doing a pod about sort of religious/spiritual beliefs, and the fact that we live in, you know, what's relatively, I wouldn't even call it atheistic, but, you know, non-religious society, so to speak, or secular society. But I don't fully believe that. I think that we have what amounts functionally to religious beliefs. We just don't call it that. And we may not even recognize it as belief. We may recognize it as truth, which I suppose is what religion is, right? I don't know. I need your help on terms here. But the point being that I do think we do believe in gods, and that they're financial in nature. I think we believe in these financial markets as the functional equivalent of gods, and there's a lot of attendant organized religious structures around these gods, and that's kind of the world that we're living in.
Well, the ultimate rational power, right? And the faith is the faith part is that whatever judgment this system metes out is fair. So if you
and
buy
wise,
into that,
yeah. Yeah.
Then if you buy into that, that means that if you are poor, then that's the equivalent of the sinner, and you have what's coming to you, basically. This is old in America. You know, this worship of money, right? And yes. I think to your point, I'm sorry if I cut you off. I'm sorry if you didn't finish.
No, keep going with it.
Yeah, my personal belief on this, pun intended, I suppose, I don't know, is that I don't think a secular society exists. I think we're kind of at a terminus of this experiment. Yeah. We kind of position them as oppositional, right? A traditional or faith-based belief system, you know, a traditional culture versus like a modern liberal secular society. And I think we're running up against some deep contradictions that kind of show us that there is no such thing. If you remove faith or religion or the structure, the cognitive and, you know, spiritual, whatever hole is in our psyche that the structure, superstructure of a God provides for us, we will fill it. That hole doesn't go away.
Yep. Yep.
And I think I'm borrowing a Nietzschean, you know, construct here. This idea that, you know, as humans, we kind of have modules that are built into us, right? If we want to take the metaphor of like a computer, right? Like there's a CPU, a GPU, you know, memory, a screen, all of that, you know, all these components. And we're kind of pretending right now that if you just take away like the CPU or something, that we can just kind of function.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think my belief is that no, we've just been ignoring the CPU for a very long time.
Yeah.
I've strained that metaphor past where it can go, but I hope it comes across that, you know, I think the central tenet of a liberal secular society is that, you know, there's a, you don't need that. You're completely on your own. This is where that this concept of freedom, freedom and individualism comes in, that you can, you know, you can find in yourself and in the world around you meaning, fulfillment, purpose, that is, that transcends the need for a God or the I guess it's framed as a kind of oppression that, yep, you know, a traditional culture imposes on the individual. It only serves to like degrade or profane the sacred individual.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about theology, but I think it's I love it that I think we're all three of us we three are in agreement about this point. And it didn't used to be a point that people could agree on very easily. And namely that, I want to make a couple of distinctions here. One is that the necessity of a post-secular analysis of what's going on. This is to be, you know, this is about our analytical or our conceptual frameworks, our horizons, whether we accept an essentially liberal and secular analytic to understand where we are. This is to be distinguished from, I mean, at the most basic level, what people actually believe, whether you're a person of faith or not, that it's actually, you know, that's not even something we have to begin talking about before we begin asking this question, whether the actual terms given us and sort of described as secular terms for understanding what's going on are adequate. So there's that first one. And another distinction is this. We may actually already be in a kind of post-secular society. That is, that a society doesn't even work the way the secular hypothesis would have it. So we're all under the shadow. One way of talking about this is we're in the shadow of, or in the wake of a secularization thesis that has been extremely influential. And even if in academia people say, oh, we are beyond that and so on, you know, modernity is multiple, there isn't just this one modernity, and, you know, it's all leading to one direction with the disenchantment of everything. And you have this sort of rational modernity in which all the gods are banished. So if you believe that theory, people have observed for a long time that that's not what's happening. But I think we're still under the influence of that doctrine. There's the expectation that if you're a modern or a rational person, what it means is that these categories or these forms of analysis are beyond the pale, so to speak. You're really reaching for something else. I want to distinguish our conversation from, you know, something that was out there when we were, a couple of decades ago. You had people talking about spirituality. There have been these returns, haven't there? In the 60s, for example, a kind of return, the sort of the hippie thing. And then later on, you had the rise of this sort of new age consciousness, this spirituality. People talk about, I mean, you still get people talking like that. I want spirituality, not religion. No, this is not what we're talking about, actually. So much is out there. That's how people still talk. But I'm talking about understanding something. And the interesting thing about the question as posed by Teen is, hey, even to understand what's really going on in the economy and how people actually behave, the purportedly very rational, secular, economistic terms given to you to understand this are actually a mystification. They're actually a mystification. That you're better off trying to understand these people, for example, as some sort of, I don't know, a cult of some sort. That you actually, and this is an anthropological point, that they behave in terms that sort of the anthropologists of religion might understand. And then there's a step that on another level, you might look at it as, well, also they have certain theological beliefs. And I mean by theology, just rational thought, systematic thought on these categories. So I think this is a great, I mean, this is a great setup, and I love being here with you guys on this.
So John, one question. So when you refer to mm-hmm. they, are you referring mm-hmm. to like the bankers, you know, the people at the Federal Reserve? Who are you referring to when you say they?
When I talk about
that
the economy,
they behave
for example.
Like a cult. Uh-huh. So people who kind of buy into this perception of the way the economy, works?
I think the normal way of talking about it, I think I would possibly have, I have spoken like that. I would adopt that if I was in their company and I was talking about how, for example, what interest rates, rates hikes would do, how the market's going to behave. There is a whole way of talking about this thing that's developed over 100, 150 years about the economy.
Yes.
Right.
And I think that I thought about that too when I was like look, the reason I thought about this is because this is a personal question, right? Because I think I'm at a point where I'm realizing that for a good chunk of my life, I basically lived according to this script, to this sort of religious belief. The thing is, and I'm curious, maybe there's one question to jot down for me is like, is there a difference between a religious society that knows it's religious and a society that's secular but has religious-like beliefs but doesn't know it, right? But functionally, right. It's the same. And that's the thing I think is going on.
Yep.
We've never had a real test of the letter, and I think that could be very scary because this is a version of like Dunning-Kruger at scale, right? Mm. How a society that does not have a conception of itself as having bounds, you can justify basically anything under that kind of rubric.
Yeah, though I just don't know whether it matters whether we recognize this as religious or not. I don't know, but I'm just positing that we don't know. Well, we haven't realized this yet at large anyway. But if you think about it, the idea's been there from the very beginning with this notion of the invisible hand and you know, sort of the way that around the same time we got Darwinian evolution as a replacement to intelligent design or God's creations, we got this notion of this invisible hand. And rather than a sort of like God king or God lord that's sort of similar to a ruler, a separate being above all of us, there was this sort of like new idea of a collective, that the God was something that was the collective of all of us in this Darwinian soup or in this complex market system. And so the financial markets have a sort of like inherent there's a permanence to their God-like status, because it's sort of axiomatic that whatever this market collective intelligence knows and is communicating back to us is more than any one of us could ever know, because it is literally defined as the sum of or the amalgam of all of these separate intelligences, right? These separate actors that are interacting with each other, and the net outcome of that is this unknowable, transcendent thing, this almost like an oracle, and it speaks to us through price signals. And you know, the price signals are never wrong. What's wrong if there are mistakes that are made, it's because we didn't read those price signals carefully enough, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, it struck me that you know, we may be coming around to a point where we're having a crisis of faith collectively in the infallibility of the markets, and I certainly feel that way. The question is, what happens if you have a loss of faith, but you didn't even know you were like faithful? You didn't even realize you had faith.
You didn't realize you had. Sure. It was faith.
Yes, it's such a weird feeling, guys.
You know, in Marx's terms, there's this, you know, he talked about commodity fetishism, right? And I mean, he has this wonderful turn of phrase. He says, the analysis of commodity is, I mean, commodity, it turns out, is a very strange thing, abounding in metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. He's being sort of semi-ironic here, but not entirely. He understands that we mystify. The economy is a system of mystifications of what's actually going on. In his terms, what's actually going on is social relations, relations of production, right? What he calls social labor. But there is this kind of system of mystifications. But what Thien is saying is that even this system is starting to, we're losing faith even in that. We're losing faith in our mystifications. So there is this, you know, if we begin with, let's assume we understand or accept that the economy, for example, and the way we talk about it, and modern life is not the secular, rational thing it's all cracked up to be, that it rests on a body of, and it remains enchanted. But, you know, we're losing faith even in that. There's a second, in Nietzschean terms, death of God. Is that? Yeah. Jasmine, I knew you'd like that one.
Yes.
The yeah. Nietzschean.
It occurs to me that you're describing two pieces, like there's two movies, actually. Although one's a book, too. Like the movie Pi, John, have you seen it?
Yes. Yeah, I think, yeah, yes.
The Darren Aronofsky.
Aronofsky. Yeah. I rewatched it recently, and actually, I mean, it's kind of a hilarious movie in retrospect, because this idea that the market is kind of,
an emanation of
God. Like they're literally, like there's mystics, there's like Kabbalah mystics trying to search for God in the Tao. Right? And the that, core...
The D-O-W Tao.
Mm-hmm, the Tao, yes.
The Taoists.
Yeah. Basically, yes, the new Taoists.
Yes, yeah, the Taoists.
Yeah. So it's kind of hilarious. So it's very tense. It's a well-made movie. I enjoyed it. It just requires a little suspension of disbelief on the core premise, which is, and it's not discounting, like this could entirely be a fever dream of a deranged mind. Like that's definitely a possibility that's left open to interpretation on the part of the viewer. But if you take it at face value for what amounts to like 90% of the movie, and this movie's been around for 20 years. So I'm not apologizing for spoilers or anything. It's basically this brilliant, you know, mathematician / yep. Hacker mm-hmm. who is searching for who is basically cracking the stock market, and it basically depends on the assumption that it operates kind of on natural law. That it's not a human. You can't assume that there's human inputs into this, because human inputs, you introduce variability, bias, corruption, manipulation. All of that is kind of removed from the equation. It's a very pure expression of exactly what you're articulating here, Thien, quote, the market, which is expressed like a law of nature. Like he's actually trying to tunnel into some law like gravity or something.
Yeah, you know what? He's actually re-enchanting the market, re-enchanting the financial markets.
There you go.
In the sense that to enchantment, if enchantment means that there's this natural thing governing it, and not just it's not just the aggregate of our inputs, particular inputs into it, there is that re-enchantment, and that's why it becomes almost religious, right? Hasidic Jews get involved looking mm-hmm. for the pattern, the code, cracking this code and understanding this thing, and mm-hmm. it's a glimpse into something real, unlike the markets, mm-hmm. which are real only to the extent that they reflect our behavior. But yeah, this is a kind of re-enchantment story. So one theme of this discussion, of course, is enchantment and the loss of it. But Thien is really talking about disenchantment even with this fundamental theology of the market.
Yeah, and I'm not...
That is really interesting. That I haven't heard before.
I'm not saying this... I'm not bringing this up because I find it curious or interesting. I'm saying this because after spending, you know, my entire career I've been working for close to 20 years now in the financial world. You know, people's lives are, you know, they're on the line based on what these markets say. You know, you'll have whole communities, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, people thrown out on the street or whatever, if the markets say one thing or another. Companies rise and fall based on markets. People's livelihoods, you know, are tied to that. You know, like, it's a real thing. Like, it's a, you know, like, people's, the outcomes of people's lives are intimately tied to the financial markets. And I never really had a problem with that, because I'm like, well, the financial markets, you see, are, you know, to the extent that the markets punish you, it's because there's this higher sort of wisdom. And it's not an alien wisdom. It's the wisdom contained in the collective. That is, it's almost a purely democratic process by which this collective intelligence... See, it's a step above traditional religion in a way, because it's not supernatural. There's a naturalistic...
How is it a wisdom? It seems to be a phenomenon, but how is it a wisdom? That's really interesting. How is it a wisdom? How is it an intelligence? As opposed,
I mean,
to
you're describing a kind of machine, kind of automation of will.
It's a collective. Well, think about whatever it is we have. Our intelligence, our wisdom, our judgment has been, we've essentially loaned it out to the extent that we're market participants, which we all are in a way, either direct or indirect. But we've, all of our intelligence and wisdom has been sort of lent out and uploaded into this market system, and it has incorporated all of us. Like, we are, it's kind of like chat, it's this chat GPT of all of us. Right.
I mean, you're describing how it's perceived, not what it is, then, right? Maybe the operational definition of the quote the market is more relevant to us than what it actually is.
That right? is the theory of it. Yeah, I'm not... I don't really know what it is. And I don't think any of us truly understand... Well, maybe some of us do, but I don't think anyone truly knows. I think that it is something that's a little bit beyond... Look, if we actually knew how this thing worked, I mean, everyone would be able to make money every day on the market, right? I mean, we just don't know. It is indeterminate. It's volatile. It's not linear. It's extremely complicated. But I don't know if that necessarily makes it smart or wise, but I think the perception is what this thing is supposed to be is this sort of unknowable amalgamation of all of our individual intelligences and judgments and emotions, all of it. And it is processed via this, you know, millisecond by millisecond negotiation of price, of offer and acceptance, of bid and ask, and the outcomes of those microtransactions or those mega transactions go back out into the world as prices, and then it's sort of fed back into the system by our reaction to those prices and so on and so forth. It's this incredibly complicated thing beyond all knowledge, beyond all perception. It's transcendent. And we're okay with our lives more or less being subject to the whims of this thing, because we believe that it is what we say it is, which is this transcendent, unknowable, but incredibly wise, and if not infallible, more infallible than any other thing that we could possibly...
Really? They actually think of it like that? That they actually think of it as the sum of our knowledge? I know that's a sort of pitch for it. Really?
Because it's a sum of whatever we decide to put into it.
Theoretically, it's unknowable the way the weather is unknowable. It's highly, highly complex and difficult. It's complex in the mathematical sense. But presumably it operates according to principles that we understand. And not according... Yes, it does aggregate. It does embody a lot of knowledge. But what you're talking about is something seems to me closer to AI, these language models, for example.
Yeah, I think it has. It's taking on that as a, like, for example, we often talk about the animal spirits in the markets, right? And so we'll say that the market,
Keynes' term,
the market has moods. It has a spirit. It's almost alive, and I think the belief is that those spirits are the sum of our spirits, right? And so if the people are fearful, the market becomes fearful. If the mm-hmm. people are greedy, the mm-hmm. market becomes greedy. And so it's a sort of collective embodiment of all of us. And it's not supernatural, right? Like it's a thing that actually we created and it exists and there's no supernatural aspect to it. And it works, you know, it actually operates on a mundane basis. It actually is just setting prices, right. Matching buyer and seller and whatever. It's not beyond knowledge at all. But we imbue it with this sort of...
Right.
We have so much faith in it because we don't believe it's mystical, right? And we believe it's this rational system.
We believe it's rational, and impartial. And the core fracture in the firmament, so to speak, in that front is people losing faith, realize, not losing faith, that's in the context of what we're talking about, it's kind of a loaded term, but realizing that that has been kind of a bill of goods that was sold to them, mm-hmm. right? This, you know, if you tune into the news, the Dow takes a slip and it's portrayed as kind of a society-wide existential threat. Which recontextualizes when you realize that, you know, that statistic that, you know, 80% of the stock market, what we consider the stock market, is owned by 10% of people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in essence, most people do kind of sit outside of it. They can be judged by it, but they are not participants of it. So in that sense, it kind of has taken on a supernatural level power over individuals.
And then
the impression that the people who do have their hands, you know, on the levers of this machine, they have been elevated to almost demigods, capable of mm-hmm. extreme destruction, mm-hmm. and that seems to be all that they are capable of. So,
under neoliberalism, it's given moral status, moral qualities.
Absolutely.
What it assigns and accords to each individual is necessarily just. It has been given that status as well. So it's personified. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is really mystification. It's personified. It's given an intelligence. And of course, if you just went down to it and actually asked people, they probably... I don't know if you actually interviewed them and went through it, applied a kind of Socratic method and questioned them. It might not go down all the way, this mystification of the market. You might realize that it's at bottom, it's the sum of these interactions, right? These exchange interactions. But it sure operates as if it was a sort of a being. I agree with Tina.
I would argue that that opinion on this or how it's characterized is actually split depending on where you stand in that system. Like one meme that I thought mm-hmm. was very potent, meaningfully potent in the COVID years is, you know, if you go on Twitter, a lot of people would say, you know, the Tao demands human sacrifice, right? Throw grandma into the meat grinder for the Tao.
Wow. Right. That's a great, what a phrase.
They kind of recognized its power that it holds over us.
Yeah. I mean, to every article from the CDC or some financial engineer or, you know, whoever, saying people have to submit to this or that, you know, then a common response would be, you know, the Tao demands human sacrifice. You know, it's satirical, right? It's people acknowledging that this is a machine that is fully human controlled and operated. And I think this is the heart of what like liberal media calls conspiracy theories, right? And I'm not saying that I'm not trying to give, you know, fuel to that particular fire. I think they are deranged in their own way on who they blame for this mess. But I think the core truth of it is they are recognizing that there is a small, relatively small, non-democratic cabal, basically, of very powerful people who act like God without our consent.
Even if it's out of control, even if it's not necessarily determined by a cabal, I think in parts it is, but I think it's still an unknowable, like I said, I mean, most even big time money managers like can't predict the market and they can't really control the market. Which makes it a bit like, you know, like, like a Bitcoin, right? Where it's like, you know,
it's vast. So it's a question of scale.
It's vast.
So
yeah. Like nobody has enough influence to control it. But
I remember like in the aughts, you know, especially coming out of a, you know, science and technology school where a lot of my classmates, a lot of the classmates that, you know, people respected actually took their hard science degrees and actually went to Wall Street. So, you know, like physics.
Oh, PhDs, that was a big thing for a while.
Computer science, mathematics.
And they were
PhDs.
Quantifying trading.
Yeah, and I remember the kind of mythology that was built up around them. And this ties into, absolutely, you know, the themes that Pi, the main character of Pi is a mathematician who's interested in unlocking basically secrets of the universe. And, you know, the shenanigans of the stock market are basically treated like a natural phenomenon that he's trying to apply his big brain to understand and characterize. And the same happened with these on a much smaller scale, I guess, you know, hedge fund managers were heavily mythologized, right? People, and the way they were spoken of was kind of interesting to me. They were basically were treated like they had created wealth, right? Like a physics PhD who had discovered some kind of algorithm, and then got massively wealthy. I noticed all of that came to a screeching halt when the 08 crisis, when that shit hit the fan. And it turned out it was just massive financial engineering and rampant runaway speculation, gambling with the country's economy.
But then it just went to tech, but it was the same thing with the VC.
It is the exact same thing. It is the exact
same thing. And I think in a way
thing.
With the VC
that was the
thing,
it was the same thing.
It took on an even more religious tone with VCs, where I noticed now, like, you know, I was talking to a friend about how these days we have a lot of, he's a money manager and there's a lot of asset. There's a lot of macro guys, he said, macro type market commentators who charge an arm and a leg to give their theory. And they give a theory of the whole world. I mean, they talk about history. They talk about where the United States is.
This
when
is
it comes
fascinating.
To the
you were just saying
history.
Today, right? These macro people all going big picture now.
Oh, they're going big picture, VCs do this. You know, they have a whole theory of technology and innovation and how human beings became what we are. You know, I mean, compare it to the quant trading people who are literally
like
just doing math.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, they're not. They weren't as concerned about throwing. You know, they weren't trying to narrate God. They were just trying to pump the market. You know, they were just trying, you know, they had respect for this thing, but
they weren't writing scripture.
These days we have people who are literally interpreting the market as, you know, it's almost like the scribe of the universe. And
Exactly.
Priests.
You know, it's what you were talking about in Pi. There's the reading of the tea leaves, right? You're reading reality through the markets. And I think it's indicative that it's happening at this time. So, you know, in the history of economic thought, there have been ups and downs, put it mildly, in the success or the fortunes of business cycle theory. You know, and I think particularly at times when, and some of the people who have, there are all kinds, you know, of theories of business cycles, and these people go at them across hundreds of years. And these ups and downs are supposed to be like natural phenomena. And there the market is more than just the sum of your things. It reflects something about nature, about the universe, right? About heaven and earth, that there are these cycles. There's this dream of seeing this. But I think these tend to come up more when things are breaking down, when the shit starts to hit the fan and your normal theories don't work. I think you see a return to these types of theories. when everything is normal science, in Thomas Kuhn's terms, when stuff is works and you can work within the same framework or paradigm, then you do these quant type things. You can do incremental stuff. You put the thing through the machine because everybody agrees on how the machine works. But when it's starting to break up at the foundations, you have a return to this type of even more mystical big picture type, big theory.
Yes. Yes.
Isn't it in that case?
I
think that's
God.
Happening because I'm thinking a lot about, you know, like the All In podcast, which is extremely popular now. It's a podcast with like
I cannot listen to them.
This is all they do.
Okay, first of all, since when do the priests of a failed religion become the popes? Even if we accept the logic, the fact
because
that all
each
of,
them have performed a miracle.
Each of them has a big bucks. How about that?
See, that's why I think a guy like Chamath. So Chamath Palihapitiya, I think is his name. Chamath is infamous for making his money originally from Facebook, but then through SPACs, which is one of the most, I can't believe it's even legal. But they're basically IPOs.
Well, CDOs shouldn't have been legal, and yet here we are.
SPACs are even worse than CDOs.
I know.
Basically, a SPAC is an IPO of a company that doesn't do anything except it makes a promise to go out and buy a company that does something, but they won't say which company. They just name the management team that will go out and find this company. Oh, it's a very weird form of IPO. It's a star-driven, personality-driven thing. And because everyone knows the name Chamath in that world, if his name is associated with a SPAC, people will buy it, and
it's
he pockets a load of money.
IPO.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Without doing anything. There's no company to do anything.
It's a second order, right, of an IPO. I make a promise to do this.
It's the opposite of an IPO. It's almost, you know, it's an IPO in reverse. Like typically you would build a company up to the point where it IPOs. This is you IPO first, and then you go find a company to buy. So many people lost money on this guy. I mean, he's a fraud, but the market has awarded him billions. I mean, he's rich. The kind of guy where Larry Summers stays at his house, right? So he's performed a miracle because he was able to gain the favor of this market. The market decided somehow to reward him, and that is a sign of his intelligence, of his worthiness of being someone with power, influence,
prosperity gospel. It's repackaged prosperity gospel.
But there's a whole belief system behind it where he becomes unassailable because he just has to say that I have a proven track record of knowing how to allocate capital according to the dictates of the market. I'm able to look at the market, find out where capital is needed. I'm able to raise and accumulate that capital and deploy it, and that makes for the best possible society, right? It's all according to this market scripture. And here's the thing, is that if you look at the social hierarchy in America and around the world, really, but especially in the sort of like neoliberal framework, market-driven framework, the allocation of wealth and power, meaning like the social landscape that we all live within, that we're embedded in and defines our lives, is actually driven by these religious-type beliefs about how the market picks winners. It has the authority and legitimacy to pick and choose winners. And so whether or not it's grift, the fact is if you made it from the market shines brightly upon you, and therefore you deserve more status and power. And if you're not, you know, if you're not particularly market driven, if you're not particularly interested in the market, or you're not even particularly good at the market, then, you know, you're a nobody. And nowhere is that more apparent to me than in Manhattan, you know, but I'm sure it's very apparent if you live in, you know, another major money and power center, like Silicon Valley or something like that. But when you feel the effects of this, you know, it really, dude, it really defines like your whole existence.
The person has charisma. It then has, you know, has power. Because he picked the right, investment at a particular time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it shows that he's in tune with the market, and because the market functions as a godlike superintelligence that we can't understand, it must be that this guy is godlike.
Touched with it.
He's touched godlike. With something. Yeah,
he's touched with something.
We got to trust this guy. You know, he knows how to talk to the market.
He's a medium of it, and so on. So this is what I meant. I think in maybe overly abstract terms, I said just we were taught that the thing operates in these rational terms, and yet to understand how an individual like him operates, and indeed how the market operates, you're better off understanding these things. You know, you're better off looking at it in just these. Just trying to understand what's going on, and I think the resources we draw on are some knowledge of maybe literature, of religion, just common sense, observation and description, and it's not what I was taught in econ, right? I mean, econ, I that was my undergraduate degree, and it wasn't supposed to work like this, back in the. It's very interesting that there have been these two waves. First, the whole financialization thing where everybody went into that, and then now the VC thing, and the VC thing turns out to be just as crazy and as much of a kind of religious frenzy as the other one. And all the time they're telling you this is science. This is science. This is it. If you question you question this, you're really beyond the pale. But I find it really interesting that we are talking like this at this time.
We as in the three of us?
The three of us.
Society?
The three of us are talking like this. Maybe because I had a hard, grad school was all philosophy of science. And this, it was precisely in order to create an instrument, an intellectual instrument for demarcating what is reasonable and what is real from all the hooey, you know. But it's the hooey that runs the show, and in fact, it's what helps constitute it. It does run the show. When you realize that, for example, the financial market vastly, overwhelms the real economy, that is multiples of the real economy, and of course that they're doing this QE until you financialize the thing to this extent, what's really running it? It's these perceptions. It's these mystifications. And you're not equipped to understand it. Just using your kind of tools of economic analysis. People like Kamath, they're not using economics. I mean, if they're shysters, they're appealing to an older art, right?
Yeah, that's been a persistent pet peeve of mine. It's their very studied insistence on them being passive observers of this said market or industry, despite having enormous power to influence, like numbers will move up or down at a very macro scale based on what they say. But one of the reasons why I just could stop listening to the All In podcast entirely was it was sucking me in, it's their insistence that they're merely observing and commentating on the market.
Yeah, they're scientists.
It's a very very disinterested, but well-informed opinion makers, on analyzers of this thing that exists outside of them, that they have no participation in whatsoever.
They also seem to disclaim personal responsibility for what they do saying that this is what the market is telling me to do.
Yeah.
It's actually mind-boggling to me that people who are actually suffering using the tools that these people have created are also tuning in to listen to what they have to say about technology as if it has anything. If you use Microsoft Teams, if you use Skype, if you use any of that horrible nonsense, you're actually suffering at the hands of David Sachs and Yammer. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But have you noticed that
but they are actually terrible at what they do? These are business people. So when you talk about this delineation between like the market and tech, I actually don't see one. I don't see a very clean delineation. I think the quote tech, what we commonly perceive of as tech, is actually we're still talking business. We're still talking quote the market.
That's because 99% of the market,
stock prices and IPOs and all the go-to-market and money-making strategies, I hear nothing about actual technology.
That's because I think 95% of the market is irrelevant old stuff that nobody cares about, and there's like 10 stocks that people care about now, and they're all tech stocks, right? And they are, you know, they determine everything. Everything is about these like 10 stocks, you know, the ones in Kathy Wood's ARK vehicle or whatever.
So, you know,
which is interesting, by the way, which is interesting. Kathy Wood is actually extremely devout and her ETF is called the ARK. So there's already a religious, you know, thing built into that.
Is it evangelical? Is she?
She's a market evangelist. And Jess, have you noticed? And here's the thing. Okay. So why am I bringing this up now? Mm. I've noticed an increasing amount of us versus them when it comes to people who believe in markets, like let's see, the VC community and the all-in people. There's a community now, and they have what they call the All-In Summit, which is starting to replace, it's meant to replace something like TED as a sort of a regular community of essentially what are true believers. And you know, they had Bill Gurley go up and basically give a very appealing speech about how government regulation of industry is crap, and you know, we've got to trust the market. And the point of this seems really to be the creation of an inside and outside type structure, where if you believe, you're in, and if you don't believe, if you're one of these people who have some other unorthodox belief that's forbidden, then you're out. And there's a lot of pressure to believe. If you want, there are things that you have to believe.
I just don't, for somebody outside that circle, I don't actually understand the promise here. I get it. There's a whole
promise is access and acceptance in the community.
Well, yeah, but what does it actually yield? Like most of the people, at least the early audience, like prosperity gospel, right? In one form, you know, it's the commonly lampooned one is like the evangelical circuit that ran wild in America in like the, I think that was like the 70s, 80s and into the 90s. So this, we're talking about, you know, like Tammy Lee Baker, you know, all those, very charismatic evangelical Christians, who ran, you know, basically distributed mega churches, and their entire shtick was basically collecting money from their audience, and then the promise is that, you know, by participating in this community, in this spiritual movement, you know, you will please God and he will bless you with money. That was the token by which you would know he found favor with God. He would give you money. So I don't know. That's my model for this. Apply to like the all-in people. I don't actually see the benefit. Like, what are they even promising? Will like accrue to you by being part of this?
I mean, they're a community of rich people that are using. Have you noticed how political they've become? They are creating what amounts to a sort of political insider group of extremely wealthy. I mean, we're talking about the wealthiest human beings that have ever lived, like Elon Musk, and encouraging them to enter the fray of politics and social, sort of social matters, and expanding their influence from beyond merely, you know, starting and founding tech companies, which a lot of them never did anyway.
Yep.
they were just mere investors. But going from there and becoming like these macro guys who have now sudden very fulsome and deep broad spectrum takes on human history, the direction of humanity,
absolutely
where we're going. I mean, these and guys Jamie are becoming... Dimon is,
has to be the next president or should be a candidate. I remember who's one pod where they agreed that Jamie Dimon you know should be a candidate.
Are you serious?
For example. Yep. To the extent these three they agree that more or less that there was a consensus, but they had that kind of discussion, and Jamath was talking about how, you know, it shouldn't be restricted to people who were born natural born Americans, for example, he being Canadian. But you know, ideas like this about the constitution of a state, for example, what it means to be a state, have a constitution. They have takes on all these things because, after all this is grist to their model of grift, right? You can everything is that sort of a project. It's something like a startup project, or anything could be a SPAC.
Anything can be a speculative asset. Anything can be a social experiment because they're comfortably on the other side.
Right.
Of the transaction, yeah. It's the rest of us. So this is like a pure distillation of a cult of personality then. Because I mean, as much as I hate all of them, the contempt I have for Jason Calacanis personally knows no bounds. Mm-hmm. But you know, they never say, if you do what we say, you will join the pantheon. You will join the priesthood of capital. That we have, they are shit talkers. They are
not like the evangelists who say, "If you do like what I do, you too will be saved." They, of course, are always set apart. They will always be these special ones, and it's very interesting to ask. And I think it's intriguing. You put it in terms of the prosperity model, and I think there is that there. But these guys are always a kind of high priesthood, right? They're special. They are founders. They are, and the rest who follow so diligently, I don't know what they are in this world.
I think it's become a more passive kind of you know, class,
ecclesiastical body,
priesthood, where you know, they're not promising you anything. What they're saying is, as market magicians, as market miraculists, miracle performers, all I can offer you is the truth. They're truth tellers, or at least that's what they claim to be. You know, I don't think that they're promising anyone anything in terms of, you know, Tremont doesn't sell SPACs and pushes investments on this thing. I mean, they're going for something beyond that now. They've made their money. They've demonstrated their ability to perform miracles. What they want now is to sort of like embody and inherit a bit of the power and status of what the market god was supposed to be in the first place, which is an oracle. It's a sort of truth-telling device. And you may not understand what it's saying, but it has the truth in it. And I think that's what they're doing. I think they're trying to say, they're trying to become the authorities on truth. And that's disturbing. And I think this has always been that way. Like, everyone who tries to get closer to the markets and become the market masters, you know, that it seems like this is a type of religion where they're just like, look, all we can offer you is the truth, and we're not going to guarantee any outcome for you. There's no salvation here. There's no promise of wealth. There's just the will of the market. And what the market wills is what is right and what should be and what will be. I mean, there's no other way. And you will accept the outcome of that. Meaning, if your life, if your life is a meager one, it's because you market determined that you really had nothing of value. And you're being valued at where the market appraises you to be. And I'm just telling you, I'm just a messenger of what that appraisal is. It's low. And if someone has a, you know, a fabulous existence, even if it was built on, you know, grift or crime or, you know, whatever, I'm here to tell you that whatever it is, ultimately, you were deemed to have value commensurate to the lifestyle that you can afford and what you that your you know your share of the pie is big for a reason, and it was deemed that way by this intelligence, you know.
I mean, it's descriptive. That is how things work for us. How prescriptive it is remains to be seen, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if we're pursuing a thesis that, you know, we do have like religious thought and ideology pervades our liberal Western consciousness. I think all three of us are fairly agreed on this. I just have to say, in summation, this is the most pathetic version humanity has ever come up with.
Exactly.
This is so bankrupt at all levels.
Yeah, there's a bankruptness to it akin to this notion of liberal democracy, I think, which is there's this illusion of democratic equality and contribution into the market by all. And the market is a reflection back of all of us working in concert together. This is the result of us being one.
Yeah. If we are necessarily religious, a kind of homo religiosus, this is the most pathetic sort of religion.
Yeah, because it's amoral. It's completely amoral. It's
well, we're not.
It's
we're
also not.
Not there's no.
It's just dumb.
It's not aspirational. There is no profundity to to it.
That's
it's
the beauty
basically
of it, right?
Saying it's yeah. It's, it but it's saying you know
you don't
like,
need to believe.
I think you are absolutely correct, and you know the function that like the all in guys serve, they're really describing what is an inherently a bad system, and just their ability to enunciate, articulate that is what gives them this power as oracles and soothsayers for this you know new religion, man. Yep, this is what all of human struggle and achievement and work and blood and sweat and tears, and this is what we turned into.
Yeah, this is where we ended up.
The selling point of this is though, you know, you don't have to believe. You don't have to trust. You don't have to have faith. You don't have to. You want to know where God is? I'll show you where God is. It's located on these servers in this city.
And you do have to believe. It just
you don't.
It is belief.
Okay, as someone who has wrestled with servers, yeah, you do have to pray before you work with those.
Yeah. But my point is that this is a very like base kind of religion in the sense that it's not transcendent at all. Its selling point is that there's no need to believe in anything beyond what you can see and feel and touch.
It's also very passive. You know, if these are the richest people in existence today, then you compare them with their predecessors. This is not a kind of J.P. Morgan, Cecil Rhodes, David Rockefeller approach to power. Well, they just got in there and did stuff. Usually really bad stuff. But
I don't even acknowledge their legitimacy in that regard. Yeah. Like
I'm not saying this was legitimate, but it was a kind of active, in Rhodes' case, right? Active, evil, right? Colonization of Africa. But these guys are sitting around, and I'm hearing this from you guys, and the thought they're sitting around passively, sort of talking about this, what's going on. And acting as if they're not responsible for it or don't have that. They're talking about something that's sort of alienated from all of us, that has power over all of us, right? There isn't even the activity of kind of a rogue. I don't know how to describe this, but it's extremely passive, it seems, on that score. Or if they're trying stuff that I don't know, behind the scenes manipulating something, but
I think that's what it is. I think they're using the market.
Parasitism.
They're using the market to disguise their, you know, pretty shitty behavior, and their scamminess and their grift. This is just straight up scam, and you know, selling completely bogus, worthless securities. But they're saying that it doesn't matter. I mean, it's the market. The market required disclosure. It has these rules. We go by the rules. You're a market. The market as a collective evaluates the value of these things point by point. And if a security goes up in value, that's because at that time, to the best of this market's knowledge, it was worth that. And all things are subject to change as new information comes in. And look, my point is, you can always make up some fucking lie about it, right? You can always tell the story based on this idealized version of what the market is, and basically wash yourself of any responsibility for what you did.
You see the parallel with democracy, the other great institution around the state. Yeah, it's a machine. We don't know. You run the numbers, and there the claims are explicitly made that this is the wisdom of this mythical thing called the people. And somehow by getting a majority, a numeric majority of a vote, this is the wisdom of the people. And what happens after that is all blessed. It's all sanitized. And we didn't do anything to rig the system. Democracy. Yeah. There is that, again,
because the system is just
right?
Because the system by design is simply the summation of all of you.
Yes. Yes.
Whatever the system determines, it's because that's really deep down what you all wanted. So you can't be mad at the system. It's just reflecting your will back to you. I think that's the really tricky part of these market religions. Yeah. And I think liberal democracy, like you said, is also sort of related, if not fully integrated, part of religion.
Yeah. Of this the fallacy of aggregation.
Neoliberal religion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because you ultimately can't even be mad at God. There is no separate God to lose faith in. This God that they've created for you, whether it's the democratic process or the market, is simply a reflection of yourself. And if you have a problem with it, take a hard look in the mirror and ask yourself, what's wrong with you that the market became, you know what I mean? And it's just
pure mechanism. And the attitude, the right attitude, is a kind of fatalism with respect to this. Well, this is how it is.
And self-blame.
Self-blame. You're as much as a someone in a caste society, for example, in a particular place. This is what was ordered for you.
Look, you were fully heard by God. You were fully evaluated by God.
This is what you deserve.
By the market, by the whatever. Yeah, what you got back was based on an evaluation of your merit, and that's that. And that's just the hard truth. And I think that people are losing faith in this rapidly. And I think, like, for example, the meme stonk thing is an example of where people are just like, they're mocking this thing now. Right? The GameStop, which I still think is an underrated historical event.
Yeah.
Was people sort of, it's the Jan 6th of the market. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's people
storming the market and saying, this thing's bullshit.
People. Yeah. Yeah.
It's fucking bullshit. Because the second we get control of this thing, we can demonstrate control of this thing.
Yeah.
Right? Suddenly, look, there's all these fucking regulators and police and coming out of the woodwork to kick us out of the market because suddenly they lost control. Yeah. And so I think, and they were mocking the market. They were saying the market's kind of, in a weird way, I don't know how that, I think they ended up getting folded back into the market doctrine, but I do think that there are, people are starting to lose faith or not even lose faith, but just like not even develop that faith in the first place or not even understand what the parameters of this faith are. They don't even get it anymore. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some don't even know about it.
Well, here, there was a moment of genius on their part, which is the conversion. I forget under which president, maybe that's immaterial, I don't know, this happened. The transition from pensions to like 401ks.
I think it was Clinton.
Clinton?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, Clinton is an underrated villain in the Fall of America arc. Very underrated. Between that shit, you know, the 11th hour repeal of Glass-Steagall, NAFTA, all this shit.
Handing the human genome over to private companies.
There you go. You know, the CHIPS Act, you know, the list goes on and on. And like the thing that everyone remembers is just the little blue dress.
Yep.
Like, okay, just that aside.
It's getting off too easy, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I'd forgotten about that, but thank you, now I remember.
Isn't it in the Smithsonian or something now?
Oh, God.
Yeah. Something crazy like that. Anyway, yeah.
Talking about the Human Genome Project. All right.
Yeah, that's very underrated shit, you know, but this is basically saying pensions moving from, you know, so people, workers would no longer have the guarantee of like being paid into their retirement based on a fund that they paid into while they were working for a company. It was rolled into 401ks, I know very little about this. I know that it rises and falls based on the market. You're basically buying into the market, the stock market. So in a very like this conversion was almost forced upon us. So this is bringing in, you know, the middle class, or what was the rapidly fraying middle class, into the market. So if you were, you know, a pensioned white collar worker, probably a white collar worker who had a 401k, you have to be rooting for the Dow, or you're not going to be able to retire.
Right. Yep. It was lashing everyone to this system, to this belief system.
Yeah. So you have to buy into it. But like that moment then you see a very sharp divide in people who had 401ks and the growing number of people who did not. And I think a lot of our like political schisms, you can tell, like people who are just simply outside that system altogether, simply at its mercy, but does not have any chance of receiving a benefit from it. That population is growing. So it was actually a moment of genius on that part to lash the middle class's fortunes to the stock market. And I think in that case, like the 2001 and the 2008 financial crisis really, really kind of shook that assumption then. I mean, 2008, there were so many stories. I was pretty young then, but all the stories about people who had lost like the entirety of their retirements.
Yes.
Based on the 2008 wipeout.
Yep.
So this is a growing number of people who have been forcibly pushed out of, through no sin of their own, basically. Yep. There was a real concerted push to frame like the subprime mortgage holders or people who were just taking on mortgages they couldn't afford. All that. There was a real push to kind of pin the sin on somebody. Like there must have been some blame, some personal blame. But for people who were nearing retirement, who saw all of their savings wiped out with no help, it's like, what can you say about them? What crime, what sin did they commit that justified the god of the Dow punishing them like that? So each time this happens, you see, I think there's a big population of people who just completely get just forcibly booted out the system, and they just get memory hold. The narratives move on, you know, the society.
But I think they accumulate. Yeah, well, they get memory hold out of the system, but they don't go any. I mean, they're still here.
Yeah,
so, and I think that it's we're at a tipping point now, is what I feel, because I think if someone like myself feels it, then I'm probably like pretty far down the line in people that should be feeling it.
Yeah.
So if I'm feeling it, we're pretty late stage. You know what I mean?
I agree. Likewise, you know.
So, by the way, guys, so this is, we're at an hour nine. Because I want to talk about like the kind of why I brought this up and sort of the more personal experience, the subjective aspect of this. While interesting from the sort of like, you know, objective view about, you know, just describing what I think is a state-backed religion and how it functions like a religion, but it doesn't have the supernatural aspects of you know, traditional religions, and it's very grounded in technology and capitalism and things like that. you know, to me, like, I'm bringing this up in the first place because I do think that there is essentially what, if we accept that framing of this, we're living through what I would consider like a crisis of faith at a pretty high level. Like, the entire society, in my opinion, is shook, and we're starting to question this belief. And Jess, maybe in the bonus we can talk about this, because I know you brought up Nietzsche in the past, and I'm not too familiar with Nietzsche's work, but like, I know that there's a whole thing about how the traditional concept of God had died, that people were losing faith, and that therefore we were entering a new phase of civilization, of history.
End phase. That's Nietzsche's assertion.
Mm-hmm.
Once we kill God, the basis for Western civilization has fallen.
Yeah.
We're just on a, so, you know, that's, well, his assertion.
And a new one, but it seemed like, and I don't know, you know, what he thought about what came after, or what would come after, but I wonder, I guess my question is,
Hegel has an answer to that. Hegel came a little later.
Yeah. But my question is, if we do kind of accept the idea that for the past, let's say, I mean, it's been a long time that we've been talking about, but I think we really embraced this probably in the past at today's level of fervency, like past 50 years, right? 45, 50 years since the Reagan era, I would say, is the sort of current, we're still in that current period, I would say, of beliefs. I think basically what I'm saying is our belief system today, while crumbling, is fundamentally not that different than what you would have found in 1982 or something. You know,
yeah.
If you go back and watch works like movies and books from that era, they still really hold up in terms of being of our era. Like, they don't feel like they're from the past, right? They may be a little dated, a little vintage or whatever, but they're fundamentally consistent with our current belief system. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
I agree with that. Like, I think 80s? That, you know, people talk about nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. But I see the nostalgia as kind of a mourning of the gap. Like, it's still like, you can't be nostalgic for a thing you don't know. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have to it has to be something that's very personal and personally meaningful to you to be nostalgic for it. But I think the reach back is kind of a mourning over the perceived distance that we're at now based on where we were then. But it's still recognizable and idealized in us. It's just we recognize that the circumstances around us.
Yeah. It's like looking at pictures of yourself when you were younger. You're still the same person. You just realize you faded a bit, you know, and you're like, oh, man, you know. But it's still the same. It's still the same era. We're still pining for essentially what we still think we're in. We just wish it had been more. You know, it was more vibrant then, or it was newer, more exciting, or something. But it's not a bygone era. You know, it's like,
yeah. If we could will that era back into being, we would. And, you know, in the meantime, we're just buying vinyl and rescuing Polaroid from Chapter 11.
Yeah, and doing a little bit more plastic surgery on Tom Cruise or something.
Oh, that's, yeah, sure.
All right. So should we do that in the bonus? We'll talk more about the subjective aspects.
Well, I don't know. Should we
this?
Conclude it?
Sure.
Like,
yeah, we could conclude.
I don't know. Like, so we're talking at a very macro scale. I don't know if we answered your question or grappled with it to your satisfaction, Teen.
I thought the really interesting part of your question was the personal part.
Hmm.
How we feel about this, Teen, you know.
Well, that's my point, I'm going through it as I speak.
Yes,
and it's a very strange feeling that I'm trying to give some expression to, because it's it's almost like, Jess, do you want to end it here or do you want to go on?
I mean, it seems like we're doing this kind of in chapters. So I just wanted to know if there's a summation to this kind of macro scale view of things.
We could do it in the bonus. So should we just mark this?
Yeah,
as the,
sure.
Okay.
All right. Shameless plug. Subscribe.